Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of four episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
The Slate Political Gabfest is brought to you by Blue Apron. Blue Apron sends gourmet recipes and all the fresh ingredients you need to make them right to your door. Farm fresh ingredients are perfectly proportioned and come with an easy-to-follow recipe card so you can create a delicious meal in 35 minutes or less. Visit blueapron.com/gabfest to get your first two meals free. And by stamps.com. Buy and print official U.S. postage using your own computer and printer and save up to 80% compared to a postage meter. Sign up for a no-risk trial and a $110 bonus offer when you visit stamps.com and use the promo code GABFEST.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest for September 25th, 2015, the Carly, Scotty, Franny edition. I'm David Plotz of Atlas Obscura. I'm here with John Dickerson in Slate DC's studio. Hello, John. Face the Nation, John Dickerson, that is.
Hi, David.
Squeaky voice, John Dickerson. And then
you said John really aggressively, so David, John had to,
I had to quail like,
Twitter and... back at you.
Oh, really? And then Emily Bazelon. Was that aggressive enough? Emily Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine.
Hey,
how are you
David.
Guys? Are you guys well?
Yeah. Was it just last week that we did the live show?
Yeah.
It feels like it was ages ago.
It does.
Wow.
Yeah. I agree.
Eons.
On this week's GabFest, however, past is past. This is the future. On this week's GabFest, Scott Walker, or as I like to call him, President Walker, drops out of the Republican presidential race months before the first vote. Then is Carly Fiorina's rise for real? And then the Pope visits America. Is he like a giant panda? Is he cuddly but unworthy? Or is he the real deal? Plus, we'll have cocktail chatter. And in Slate Plus, David Cameron and a dead pig. What is that? What is that story? If you are not yet a Slate Plus member, you can get it by going to slate.com/gabfestplus. Two quick announcements. First of all, our beloved intern Tarek is leaving, which means it's time for a new GabFest intern. This is a paid position, a paid part-time position. It's based in Washington, D.C., and it's a great job. It's a great, fun job. People have used it to jump into journalism, to jump into other things, and I think everyone who's done it had a really fun time. If you're interested, please...
We'll just speak for them.
We'll speak for them. Please email your resume and a cover letter about why you think you'd be good for this to gabfest@slate.com. That's gabfest@slate.com for the Slate internship, for the GabFest internship. The second announcement, on October 20th, Mom and Dad Are Fighting, the excellent parenting podcast done by Dan Coyce and Allison Benedict, will be live in Washington, D.C. at the Woolly Mammoth Theater. John Dickerson is going to be the special guest, I hear. I've heard tell. John Dickerson.
Don't tell anyone.
Oh, I just told people. I told people. You should get tickets at slate.com/live. That's Mom and Dad Are Fighting October 20th at the Woolly Mammoth Theater here in Washington. Scott Walker rode his Harley-Davidson motorcycle off into the political sunset this week. Walker, who I and many other moron pundits had dubbed the likely Republican nominee, I thought he was bound for the White House, had sunk to 0 percentage points in the polls following a very tepid performance in the latest Republican debate in California a couple of weeks ago. we can't really ask where his support will go because there is
it has gone. It has.
But we can ask where it went. John,
his
where did
donors,
it go?
His staff.
Yeah. He had two problems, only one of which was his bad campaign. Well, I guess it's a big... He had two problems. One was that he was a tepid, lackluster candidate who had no second act. His first act was compelling. And as you said, you and I also felt like he had a lot of the attributes that Republican primary voters were looking for. And he did in a world in which Donald Trump doesn't exist. But his first act was to remind people what he'd done in Wisconsin, which was to be the only governor to survive a recall. And that the whole central fight that he was engaged in was one that was in defense of a conservative principle about unions, that he faced the fiery gates of hell and did not turn back. And that's something that conservatives had previously said they care a great deal about, which is constancy in the face of pressure. Turns out now, and CBS did a poll a couple of weeks ago, when you ask people what's the number one criteria, that kind of fixity, that kind of sticking to your principles against all comers has totally dropped out. And now the number one thing they want is business experience. So Donald Trump has totally switched around the way Republicans think about what they want in a candidate, which is fantastic because it means that the thing that they used to prize, which was sticking to your guns and never changing, has itself changed in their minds, at least according to that poll.
Do you think that's a meaningful
way to look at voting?
A meaningful statistic, a meaningful
no.
finding? Isn't it just that Donald Trump is ahead in the polls?
Yeah, yeah, ergo? Yeah. Yes, okay. Ergo. But it's just funny that the whole point of supposedly looking for candidates who don't change no matter what is that you presumably think that that's a good way to behave. And yet, when a candidate comes along who you just happen to like for other reasons, you'll totally discard your affection for sticking to a single principle and never turning back. Because obviously Donald Trump
those
has...
those voters a year out, yeah, they are so fickle.
The Donald Trump has...
And why shouldn't they be?
So anyway, that's why Walker looked good. The problem is he had no second act, which is to say that when Donald Trump came along, Walker just wasn't very either exciting or interesting. His debate performances were weak. His interviews on foreign policy and a lot of different topics were weak, so that in a time when you needed to kind of stand up and make a noise for yourself, he was incapable of making a noise. And the other big problem was he spent a lot of money, had a huge staff, couldn't raise money to keep up with the organization he'd built.
Emily, do you think that the death of Walker's campaign signals more largely what John was pointing at, that in fact insider ability and governance, which you would think would be a real strength of this Republican field, there are a bunch of governors in the race or ex-governors, but that in fact has actually withered, or did it just wither in the case of Walker, and that Jeb Bush and Kasich and potentially Jindal or Christie will eventually benefit from a desire to have competence or executive experience?
I don't think we should read too much on that front into Walker's exit. Bad campaign. Also, he didn't want to go into a lot of debt. He's not a person who comes from a lot of money, and it just seems like he had a limit on his own exposure. And also, he's just one of several of those more establishment candidates. It seems to me that if the Republican primary vote returns to its more rational, normal self, then, yeah, Kasich or Bush or Christie or Rubio or Ted Cruz even, I guess, will probably still rise to the top. I mean, I just can't take the Trump Fiorina moment all that seriously myself. And I guess we could throw Carson in there as well. And yet, there's clearly a hunger for an outsider candidate, at least in this moment where voters can afford to be pretty mercurial because it's so far out.
John, was it a surprise to people that he went so fast?
It was a surprise to me that he went so fast. I mean, it depends when you decide. It's like the death of a terminal patient. I mean, you knew it was going to die, but you didn't think it was going to happen that fast. After the last debate, I think we all didn't we say that? I can't remember where I said this, but I think we were all in agreement that he had a very bad night. He needed to do well. He didn't do well. So. But in terms of the level of surprise, even the people who were giving money to his campaign thought after the last debate, there was a big phone call with all of his donors. And there'd been a lot of rumors swirling around whether Rick Wiley, who was his campaign manager, was going to be fired for, creating this huge staff and not producing results. And that firing didn't look like it was going to take place. It looked like that was just kind of in the chatter among the donor community being picked up by some reporters. So they had a meeting and they talked on the phone and said basically, okay, what we're going to do is we're going to let the super PAC spend money in South Carolina and Iowa on ads, and we're going to kind of focus the campaign itself on Iowa. He had organization in 99 counties. And so that was what a lot of the people who were giving money to Walker believed on the morning he got out of the race. So they were really surprised when I talked to them on the phone that afternoon as everybody was scrambling. And I think more broadly, the sense of surprise from, you know, a year ago when you looked at the field and looked at, you know, you wanted somebody who was outside of Washington, who had executive experience and who had a connection to the base, both the grassroots and the fundraising base. Remember, he was the Koch brothers' favorite candidate. So, I mean, he wasn't just some, like, person people were falling in love with. I mean, or random pundits were falling in love with. There was a real reason to argue for his candidacy. And I should say, finally, the fact that we're all surprised is that's what happens in politics. That's what, I mean, politics is and history is what surprises us usually. So
this is not whistle stop, John.
Well, no, I'm just saying it's like this is what makes this is what like the twists and turns of campaigns are what make campaigns.
So, Emily, where did he had, you know, 20% or so in the earlier polls? Now, the polls 3 months ago were even less meaningful than they are today. But where did those people go?
I don't know. Are they spread out all over the place? Trump, Fiorina, Rubio is a bit up since the last debate. Is that where that support went?
I think you're right. I think it went all over the place. I mean, when I went to Walker events in South Carolina a month or so ago, it was one of the places where you had people who were kind of regular old Republicans, which is to say not, you know, super hardcore members of the base who were saying, oh, you know, Donald Trump is saying some interesting things. And so when you have people at a Walker rally kind of flirting with other candidates, that maybe was a sign. One other thing we should point out is that the power of the super PACs, again, in terms of surprises, right, this election campaign, I certainly thought that candidates would be able to stay in the race longer because of the super PACs.
Yeah.
And that's not the case. I mean, Rick Perry and Scott Walker had super PAC money that they could have used, but you need those hard dollars to actually run a campaign.
Because you can use it for what? What is it that you can't use the super PAC
money
for? You can't
use it to, like, organize and your staff and you can use it for a lot, but you can't use it for your staff and your travel and the business of campaigning.
So, John, if Walker had run a more frugal campaign, would the super PAC have made more of a difference? Because they were already, like, poised to run ads, yeah, in South Carolina and somewhere else.
Right? Yeah. I mean, I guess if he'd run a more frugal campaign, he'd still be in the
campaign,
but he'd still be at zero.
Right?
So he'd still be at zero. So if it's a bad, you know, the old line is that the dogs are not eating the dog food. I mean, so if that's the case, no matter how things were arranged, the dogs would still be over eating their hearty bowl of Trump stew.
Right, but he'd be in the same boat as, like, all the other people. Well,
yeah,
I guess
yeah. Well,
really,
I mean, he'd still have a campaign. But then the question is, do you want to run a campaign at zero? I mean, his plummet is extraordinary. I mean, he got into the race in July. So that's right, basically 2 months and you're toast. And the analogy is being made to or the comparison is being made to Tim Pawlenty, who pulled out after losing the Iowa straw poll in 2012. But I don't think Tim Pawlenty was ever at the top of the polls in his party or mm-hmm. at the top of the polls in Iowa. I might be wrong, but I'm pretty sure that he was never, you know, he rolled a lot of dice on Iowa and it didn't work out for him. But Walker was seriously considered, you know, a possibility among lots of Republicans, whereas that was not the case with Pawlenty.
Do you think he's done? Is Walker done as a national political figure? He's still governor of Wisconsin, of course, but is this an abject enough defeat that he really won't be taken seriously again?
I wouldn't want him to be my vice president if I was the presidential candidate.
Well, or could he run in whatever the next campaign is, 2020 or something like that?
I don't know. I think he's got to find that second act, and in his inability to find it in this context suggests he might not be able to do it in another. But one or two successes in Wisconsin, he would turn back to being like the great conservative governor. And that's not a bad thing to be.
I would like to pause and you know, play the bagpipes around the grave of Scott Walker for a moment. Because, look, he's a terrible...
He's not dead, his
political views are terrible. He's been... I think what he's done as governor of Wisconsin is absolutely reprehensible. However, it is bizarre to me that here's this person who's a very capable politician carrying forth exactly the policies that Republican voters want. And, you know, he's not a great political campaigner, but okay, that's fine.
No,
but
he was lousy.
But he's very capable. And he's kind of punished because he's just not a rich guy, because he's a guy who wasn't rich.
I think you're being too kind to him. He was lousy. He gave weird and hedgy answers to obvious questions.
He wants to build a wall on the Canadian border.
Yeah, his signature accomplishment in Wisconsin... What?
He picked the wrong border.
Yeah, exactly.
It's 50-50.
His signature accomplishment
it's 50-50
in Wisconsin doesn't translate across the country all that successfully.
Well, but the people would have been fine rewarding him for what he did in Wisconsin if he'd been a more powerful candidate. I mean, people aren't looking at what he did in Wisconsin and saying, oh, he'll do that specific thing for the country. They're saying he'll govern conservatively and stick to his principles when he's attacked.
And actually, Emily, so you're right, Emily. He's a terrible candidate, and he didn't do a great job. But isn't it sad, going back to sort of an, I feel like I'm channeling John Dickerson here. If you want to measure leadership and executive ability, you would think that conservatives would think this guy has been an actual leader of a state very boldly, very bravely, has accomplished some great things, and has a lot of guts. And people would have liked that.
Right.
I think that the on paper Scott Walker was I'm the highest in the polls in July Scott Walker.
Not,
and then he didn't translate
beyond
that.
But I know,
right?
But it's not the on paper, it's the actual lived experience. The guy has been governor of Wisconsin for X number of years and
he was a lousy candidate. You don't get to overcome that.
I know,
but this is what he's lamenting.
That's what I'm saying.
He's lamenting he went from being good on paper to being on the canvas. I think I would add another thing to that, which is it's not just he didn't have money, that Donald Trump, who is at the head of the bus for the moment, the head of the line, he's winning all the polls. Even, by the way, we should note, after the last debate in which we all agreed that he sort of disappeared for 30 minutes and thought that might hurt him. Turns out it didn't.
Well, it hurt him a little bit.
It hurt him a little bit
to the extent that he only went up a couple of points instead of the 5 points or whatever that he went up after the last debate. But the thing is, the around Trump is not only his money, but around Trump is a cult of personality that also we should be nervous about, and that particularly conservatives have railed against with respect to Barack Obama. In other words, the affection for Trump is not really tied to much other than affection for Trump, and that's another thing we should probably be worried about, whether we're conservatives or liberals.
All right, let's hear from our first sponsor. This week's first sponsor is Blue Apron. Blue Apron, of course, is the new service that delivers all the ingredients you need to make incredible meals at home. Farm fresh ingredients are perfectly portioned and come with an easy to follow recipe card, so you can create a delicious meal in 35 minutes or less. You'll cook meals like smoky shrimp and creamy cheddar grits with corn, zucchini, and cherry tomatoes, or crispy eggplant pitas with beluga lentil salad and spiced yogurt. Discover a better way to cook. Visit blueapron.com/gabfest to get your first two meals free. That's blueapron.com/gabfest. Carly Fiorina surged to the top three in polls following the second debate of Republican candidates. She is now up with Donald Trump and Ben Carson, the three outsiders who are well ahead of the field of actual experienced politicians. Emily, why did she bounce, and is it a meaningful bounce that she's now up there with, what is it, a dozen or so percent, 12%, John?
Yeah, 15 maybe. It's not meaningful in any lasting way. I mean, she was a very powerful presence at the debate. I even liked her moment of battling back against Trump, dissing her for her looks, and she had a really effective ad building on that same point. But her record at Hewlett-Packard is truly terrible. Her distortions and falsities about Planned Parenthood and the video she claimed she saw, which does not exist in the form that she said she saw it, just make her very vulnerable to any kind of real scrutiny. And I also just think there is something unappealing about her if you really, like, hang out with her for more than 5 minutes in a debate. And that's why she lost badly to Barbara Boxer. I mean, let's take this back a step. This is a person who lost a Senate race to a not very good Democratic campaigner,
Barbara Boxer. Well, but in an extremely Democratic state.
Yeah, well, that's true. And an incumbent with some benefits.
Yeah, but I still feel like if Republican voters are excited about someone with a business record, do they really want to pick someone who essentially ran Hewlett-Packard into the ground? And her defense that, you know, revenues doubled is a totally specious defense, because revenues doubles because she bought some, you know, made a bad deal in buying Compaq, not because she was, like, wringing more value out of that company.
All right, John, let's pull back from the Emily Bazelon hack job on Carly Fiorina for a moment. You've done the entire arc of Carly Fiorina criticism. You've done an entire like negative campaign against her in 30 seconds. I'm interested in
why
she popped up.
Someone defend her. So what does she have to offer the Republican electorate? Please tell me.
Well, I think I think she popped up because people are looking for politicians who aren't politicians. So, you know, between Trump, Fiorina, and Ben Carson, you got to kind of pick.
Too bad that, like, the three of them can't be rolled into one plausible candidate. But I don't know. Do they even have enough strong points among the three of them that would work?
Well, it depends what you
I think she... Look, again, I think she's wrong on everything. But I thought as a debater, it is true that she made stuff up, but she made it up with such
authority
and such confidence.
Okay, but David, is that supposed to have lasting value? Like, maybe that's great for one night, but do we really want a world in which, like, oh, you make up whatever you want on the debate stage and that propels you into serious contention in the long term? This is like the opposite of your point about Scott Walker.
I know.
I
don't want her to be. I also agree. I'm sort of loath to say this because I think it's very hard to say it without coming across as some form of grotesque sexism and nastiness. But something like really off-putting about her that I find.
Let's think of an adjective that's safe. We can't say she's shrill. We can't say she's strident. I tried harsh last week and got some criticism for that. And yet I completely agree with you. And there are other Republican candidates I would say basically the same thing about. I find Chris Christie to be really irritating at the moment. Ted Cruz, yuck. So I'll just throw in Zemen. But yeah, she is not an appealing, warm person, at least in the way she plays on camera.
All right, now, John, now Emily and I have both hacked at her, even though I said I wasn't going to.
Talk
about her.
We all talked about why, after the debate, people thought she did well, and that's enough right now to help you in an incredibly soft environment in the Republican Party.
But does it
Party.
Stick?
I don't think it sticks. Like, no.
Why do you think it doesn't stick for her,
even if
it sticks for Trump or something?
Well, I guess I would put it this way. I think... So if we think of this race as Trump and not Trump, what lane does she pick up? Does she pick up a bunch of the kind of more moderate establishment type of voter that...
God, I hope they have more sense than that.
...would otherwise go for, you know, Bush and Kasich and maybe Rubio and Christie? Do they think, well, you know... Because that group of people, if they're even considering Rubio, Bush, Kasich and Christie, is not... so anxious to have a non-politician that they'll throw everything else aside. So for that group, you could imagine her record at Hewlett-Packard, which is her, in a sense, it's her greatest selling point. She comes from the corporate world. And yet for that group, it would be something where they're like, yeah, well, you know, unanimously fired by the board and not hired by another tech firm for 14 years is an insurmountable problem for that group. So if she's not going to pick up the votes over there, she's going to have to pick them up from the Trump group. And since she's in open warfare with Trump, I don't know. I feel like it doesn't last. I'm not quite sure how it falls apart, except for that there's just not enough room. That if it's a race of Trump and not Trump, she's not enough not Trump to be the alternative who rises.
Does she get to be a vice president contender?
You know, I don't know. It depends who the candidate is, because, you know, if it's Jeb Bush, does he really need...
Jeb Bush doesn't pick someone with such a crappy business record. How about Trump Fiorina? That would be just extremely entertaining.
Yeah, well,
they could punch each other.
That would be very entertaining. And Trump might do that to if he starts having trouble with women voters. But at the moment, he's not having trouble with women voters in the Republican primary field. So
John, you don't think... I mean, the other thing about Fiorina is there's a claim, and there was a... I think there was a New York Times story about some Trump appearance where the crowd wasn't there, but the claim that she has finally sort of put the hole in the balloon and it's now starting to leak, and So even if she herself doesn't sustain it, that she has swung the axe that will end his campaign.
She swung the axe into the balloon. But I don't know if that's really what we see in the polling, because what we see in the polling is him basically staying where he was, going up a tiny bit, 1 or 2 points, which is meaningless. And then she's rising. So some of that's coming out of Carson. Some of it's coming out of other politicians. But it's not – there's not a huge chunk that she's taken out of Trump. So to the extent that she's in the debates and closer to him physically because of her position in the polls and because everybody's listening to her and watching her in a way that they weren't before, she could take him down. But I don't know if in taking him down, it all accrues back to her. Mm-hmm. I think she potentially serves the role that, you know, when Gephardt, I mean, this is such a cliche, Gephardt attacked Dean, it helped Kerry.
Right. That's what I was
saying.
So right.
That's possible, but that didn't help Gephardt.
So Emily, who is looking at Fiorina's rise? What other candidates are looking at Fiorina's rise and saying, either this is terrible for me or this is great for me? I assume that Marco Rubio is saying, this is awesome, good. Now Trump and Fiorina are going to bleed each other, and I'm going to be the person who's going
to
rise.
And the polls have shown he, second to Fiorina, has gotten the biggest bounce out of the last debate.
Right. I agree with that analysis. I can't really think for whom it's bad that she's taking away some of Trump and maybe, I mean, I guess Carson. Maybe Carson feels like he wants to be the alternative to Trump. I don't really see who else she hurts.
Who
and
she did take
a little out of Carson.
Right.
Who else
I mean,
she hurt,
she's going to be like, she's popped up. She's like the flavor of the month. And then she's going to go away because people are going to get turned off by all the negative
But
news.
Why do you say
Not
that?
Not even
why,
news
why
reporting
are they necessarily
about her business
get,
record.
I mean, somebody has to win something. Somebody has to. Somebody will be the Republican presidential nominee.
But not
someone's
going to
win Iowa. Someone's going to win. Someone's going to win.
I mean,
New Hampshire.
I think you could imagine a bunching where it's where in a little bit of time, Trump comes down a little. Fiorina sort of goes up. Carson up. You know, where everybody's staying around the like 14 to 21 point range, and you've got about five
or six. Does one of them
people.
Win Iowa, John? Do you think, or are you not sure?
One of who? I think
those three. Folk.
Yeah, I think I don't. I think that's a
Seems
great question.
Like one of them wins Iowa.
It does. It's a great question because Rubio and Jeb are not even close in Iowa. Neither is Christie. So and
right.
Kasich really isn't. So you know, Trump, Fiorina, Carson win. I think you could imagine Carson winning in Iowa. Carson has a kind of sort of quiet feeling that could pull it off the way Santorum and Huckabee did. He obviously also has the religious piece. But I don't know. It just feels like Carly Fiorina is having a well-deserved moment, but it feels like a moment.
But, so you don't think there's any possibility that she actually becomes a respectable kind of go-to candidate. I mean, she, you know, she's had a real career as an executive. Now
yeah,
it's
yeah,
checkered,
yeah. I'm not.
And she's run for office before, and she has some money, and she's a woman, which is a huge portion of the electorate that they need to get at. I don't see why she might not have endurance.
Because once people really spend time with her, they're going to discover that she was a terrible corporate executive, which is her main selling point, that she's lying or getting wrong major things that she says over and over again, and that as we're
well, so is Donald
saying,
Trump. So is Ben
you
Carson.
And me are admitting she's not appealing.
Yeah, but
David
so
makes
Donald
a good,
Trump.
David
so
makes a
Donald
good point.
Trump.
If being wrong about things that you say was disqualifying, there would be nobody running.
I mean, this is. I think.
But
this
I
is
don't
all
think
presumed.
Trump is going to win either. I still feel like Rubio comes from behind and is like checks all the boxes I just laid out. He's not. I haven't heard him lie or get important stuff wrong. He is appealing. And he has a pretty good record as a politician. Certainly not anything we've heard about that's going to axe him.
Yeah. All right.
But I was all like you. I was pro Scott Walker. So I'm sure I'll be wrong about this, too.
OK. So,
well, here's the thing about that. Here's the distinction about between Walker and Fiorina is that you could build a case for Walker. I find it harder. I mean, just because of, you know, you could amass some facts that could come up with a case for Walker. It's harder for me to do that with Fiorina. I don't know where.
Right. She, on paper, is not a good candidate.
Well,
what do you mean she's
well,
not
no,
a good candidate?
She's a
I don't agree with you.
No,
about that.
I think.
You don't care that she was a mass Hewlett Packard?
She was,
she was
the most powerful woman in American business for a decade, practically. She was.
And
it's
then
true.
She got fired because she,
got fired.
She messed
Who
up
hasn't
the company.
Fired? Who
I guess,
got,
but the point that the outsider come hell or high water vote is right now sitting largely with Trump and Carson. And either she's going to take down Trump and somehow pick up those votes, but I just don't see her. If Trump and Carson represent, you know, 46% of the vote, then the rest of it is are the kinds of voters who are split with the other candidates and who might have pause about Hewlett-Packard and therefore aren't going to go rushing to her. And that's why it's hard for me to figure out where she gets her votes from absent a collapse by Trump or Carson.
One last question about her, John, actually. Does she have a campaign infrastructure?
Yeah, it's not as good as Scott Walker's. she has a campaign infrastructure, but I think and it's early enough where she could still kind of keep going. And if she has enough momentum, she could get enough of one. I mean, when I was out in January in Iowa, she was doing all the things you need to do as a candidate to meet with all the small activists. And by that, I mean, you know, people shorter than 5'7". activists all over the state and doing the work you have to do. So she's not just trying to kind of figure this out at the last minute. But I don't know how, in truth, I don't know how robust her organization is. I know she's been trying to build one. And if she catches fire, she should be able to. Because she's now got a lot of, like, there are a lot of Walker staff out there. And when you're staffers trying to hook up with a cause, you're a little more, you can get them because in some cases you're paying them. You know, some staffers are mercenary.
Let's hear from our second sponsor, which is Stamps.com. Your to-do list can seem out of control. Oof, that is true for me and probably for you guys. So much to do, so little time. But there's one thing you can check off your to-do list: going to the post office, thanks to Stamps.com. With Stamps.com, you can buy and print official U.S. postage right from your own computer and printer. Stamps.com will send you a digital scale, which automatically calculates the exact postage you need for any letter or package, any class of mail. You'll never waste valuable time going to the post office again. You can do everything right from your desk with Stamps.com. Print the postage you need, put it on your letter or package, then just hand it to your mail carrier, and you're done. Right now, we have a special offer. Use our promo code GABFEST. You'll get a 4-week trial and a $110 bonus offer, which includes the digital scale and up to $55 in free postage. Don't wait. Go to stamps.com. Before you do anything else, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in GABFEST. That's stamps.com. Enter GABFEST. Pope Francis is in America. He's been received like a surprise Beyonce album, like a Red Sox World Series victory. Washington came to a virtual standstill during his visit this week. It was covered wall to wall on the cable networks. The Pope met privately with the president. He visited with the poor and the sick. He canonized an American saint. He worked crowds intimately and warmly. He spoke to Congress. And as we tape, he's off to New York, where he will do some more of the same and talk to the UN.
And Philadelphia, please
the city
include
of brotherly
my city.
Love. Yes. So, Emily, his visit has clearly been a triumph, but why has it been a triumph? In what way is it a triumph? Is it because Democrats and liberals are so pleased that he's come with a message of action on climate change, welcomeness on immigration, inequality, or is it a triumph for other reasons?
I think it's a triumph for that and for other reasons. I mean, it seems to me like Pope Francis has amazing crossover appeal. So his approval rating among Catholics is like near 90%. And then among Americans,
God,
it's like,
so.
I think,
what Catholic being asked, like, do you approve of the Pope? Is going to be like, don't approve of him. Seems like a quick,
yeah, but I
quick
think some people don't like the Pope. Look, no, there were three Catholics on the Supreme Court who didn't show up for his speech in Congress today. Those would be Samuel Alito, Antonin Scalia, and Clarence Thomas. I mean, that seemed like a pretty resounding
That's
set
outrageous.
Of
I didn't realize
yeah,
that.
I mean, it seems, John, people can decide they don't like the Pope, right?
They can. It is, it's a little trickier. It should be a little trickier the more devout, the more sort of devout and judgmental you are. Well, I mean, it depends. If you've been so strict in the way you interpret things, then it seems to me you can't just come up with your own view about the Pope. It would seem harder for a strict constructionalist to kind of excise the Pope than a kind of more liberal Catholic who would be like, oh, I take a little of this, I take a little of that, and that's That's what I believe. I mean, but the American Catholic experience is much more the cafeteria Catholic who, you know, I mean, in 1960, all the bishops, or I guess 1959, the American bishops were asked about birth control, and they said, oh, no American Catholics would ever use birth control. And then the pill was made legal, and Catholics were using it like crazy, and it caused quite a moment of challenge for the priests and nuns, because the flock was not behaving in the way that they thought it should. And that's then, of course, true with capital punishment and abortion and other issues in which people are separate from whatever the church, you know, positions are.
But what? So, okay, Emily, why was it why has it been triumphant so far?
Well, first of all, talk about personal appeal. I mean, he seems to have so much of it. He is like super good at kissing babies and walking around and just making people feel like they're in this very special, you know, potentially divine and benign presence. And then I think the fact that he has been saying things that liberals are so happy to hear a pope say about climate change, about taking care of refugees, about poverty and capitalism and inequality expands his appeal to people who normally wouldn't pay that much attention to him. I mean, so the rabbi at my synagogue devoted his whole Yom Kippur day sermon to the pope and like the history of Jewish Catholic relations and why he feels really hopeful about
we're
it
making,
right now. And
making
he's
inroads.
Like a, you know,
we're joining right? John. Can we have membership? Can we get like a membership in the club?
I think, yeah.
Ancillary membership?
Yeah. So I think, I mean, the biggest...
We won't be there on Christmas, though. We'll help work out. We'll help. We'll like serve on Christmas.
I think that...
We'll be the Jewish people.
I think
the
Pope's message is that you serve all the other days other than Christmas, not just on Christmas. But, you know, I think the Christian affection for him is that basically he is behaving the way either in... The things he does, like stepping out of mass to go embrace a severely disfigured man and then kissing him and praying with him, he is behaving the way people would think Jesus might behave. And he's taking the entire huge lens of the Catholic Church and saying, focus on what Jesus says. You know, if you have like... just go, you know, read the Beatitudes and behave like that. And that is a returning home to kind of the purest part of Christianity in a lot of people's minds. And to have somebody acting that way and celebrating that and doing all the things he does, little and small, to keep the focus there on love and on decency and dignity, that's... It feels warm for people who sometimes feel the church is kind of off doing some weird thing and obviously the church, the Catholic Church itself is fractured and has had, you know, serious issues with pedophile priests. So that's another, you know, that adds another element to the extent that you can be in the news for something else other than something bad has also been good.
Is it possible for this pope to be non-political? So my rabbi's argument was that it's important to understand his declarations and teachings on moral terms, kind of apart from the partisan political universe. And yet, you know, once you show up and hang out with President Obama and talk about American policy, you've sort of crossed that line.
Well, popes have always crossed the political line. I think that his argument would be that the thing he is most fixated on is the human being. And so whether it's the unborn child or the death row inmate or the immigrant, if you look at his remarks in front of Congress when he talked about accepting the human who is trying to get into your country or who is in your country illegally, that you should just blow past the policy and deal with the fact that there's a human life here and to treat that life the same and with all the respect and dignity it deserves because it is a life.
Yeah.
And that if you want to attach a policy, you want to attach an ideology to that human life, go ahead. But I'm not concerned with that. I'm concerned with treating every human life with that level of dignity.
I mean, it's funny. Obviously, politically, I'm very sympathetic and aligned with his overall message on immigration or on climate or on inequality. But those didn't move me. What moved me is exactly what you just talked about, John, is this idea that our highest duty is to people, is just to, you know, to treat human beings with dignity and respect and humility. Not that, I mean, not that I'm doing that. Not that I managed to live that life. But like, it certainly, that was what spoke to me. It wasn't the fact that, oh, the Pope believes in climate change. Hurrah, we're going to get some good legislation out of it. That seemed unimportant and distracting, in fact, from this message. All the things, and when I think about this Pope, I think about him, you know, the phone calls he makes to people or the specific human actions he makes. That is so incredibly powerful. And the political stuff seems, it just doesn't seem useful in the same way that the human behavior seems.
And I, one thing that amused me about his speech to Congress was that, speaking of cafeteria Catholics, so there's the normal drama that we, false drama that we associate with State of the Unions, where people will clap for one thing or another. But I mean, in this case, you had the ideological views kind of clapping for one sentence, which is to say, this is the word of God, and then not clapping for the next sentence because, no, that we don't believe in that. So it was like cafeteria Catholicism through applause. It was fantastic.
I actually found that speech to Congress hilarious. Someone said to me, this is like a scene from Veep, that because his accent was so thick, you couldn't. Half the time, I didn't understand exactly what he was saying, and people would be getting up and cheering, and you would think, well, I hope they're clapping for the thing that they think they're clapping for, because I sure didn't understand what he said.
Did he say Doris Day or Dorothy Day?
Yeah. Doris Day would be very, you know, I loved his reworking of Matthew 7 when he said, the yardstick we use for others will be the yardstick which time will use for us. And the fact that he used time instead of God, I wonder if that was a choice or just, you know, he was just looking for words and those are the ones. Because it's a big difference. Because when you speak of how time will judge us, you can get a bigger audience than you can speak to a secular audience
right.
in that when you use that word. But if you use God, you limit it. And I thought that was fascinating if that was it was an actual choice.
Do you guys think there will be any political upshot of this? Will any political candidates use the Pope for their benefit? Will there be actual legislation which will draw on this? Will this change political opinion in specific ways that causes action in this country or not?
I don't feel like it translates directly. I feel like the politicians who perhaps should be moved by him because they're Catholic and you're supposed to listen to the Pope are going to figure out a way to just ignore the things they don't want to follow. There will just be silence. A deafening silence on climate policy, for example. Or then the other thing people say is like, oh, well, he shouldn't be entering into this political realm. I feel like it's this amazingly wonderful feel-good moment for the country, and I'm really enjoying it. But maybe this picks up on what you were saying before, David, that his power is to get us to think about these very human interactions rather than really like affecting policy and politics.
Well, we're going to I'll be interviewing John Boehner this weekend, who was clearly moved by he's worked his basically whole life in Congress to get the Pope to come. He was a mess for the period, particularly when they went out on the balcony. And I'm interested in somebody for whom the faith is a very serious part of his life and his tradition. And yet,
when you say he was a mess, do you mean he was crying?
I mean, he was crying. He was emotionally overcome by the presence of the Pope. And I mean that in the best possible way.
Is John Boehner going to have an epiphany and suddenly be like, oh, we need to pass laws to, you know, control carbon dioxide emissions?
I don't think so. But it's interesting to see where people draw their own lines. And so, and why and how we all get inspiration and then where we choose to have it stop. Because obviously he was emotionally, engaged with this visit. And yet, as you say, it's unlikely he's going to have. And that's but I guess my point is that is the Catholic experience, is that you can have devout Catholics who would have that same emotional reaction and yet who don't feel like every word the Pope says is they must go march in that direction. And so,
right. And to be fair, Democrats who are Catholics are also picking and choosing. I mean, they're not going to follow his teachings
on
abortion and birth control.
Yeah, absolutely. That's why I meant the cafeteria Catholicism goes both ways. It's both the Republicans and the Democrats, which, again, misses the point of the Pope's main argument, which is pay attention to the human. And so, you know, it'll be interesting if that gets through.
I weirdly, I didn't see very much of his visit, but I saw a bit of him on TV this morning at the gym. He was outside the...
He was at your gym?
The Pope was at your gym?
Was he on the elliptical machine next to you?
I did have the thought, does the Pope... Because the Pope, he looks a little bit overweight, whether he works out. And if the Pope works out, what does he work out in? I had a friend who's a priest, and he...
You know what he lifts, David? He lifts souls.
Yeah, but, you know, is that cardio? Is that more cardio? Or is that...
I feel like it's too, you know, profane working out.
Why is working out profane? I mean,
No. The body is a temple. We are made in God's image. So you want to, you know, keep it trim.
He loves soccer. God, he's a huge soccer fan.
That's true.
I was at the gym, but I was tearing up. I'm like a secular Jew. And I was watching on some small TV, watching the Pope,
but,
you know,
like,
just
what is
glad
that about?
Why
are so many
up?
Secular Americans and Jews having... Is that just like, oh, we're so excited that he seems like he's nicer and more on our side than the last guy?
No, to me, it is totally the human... The climate change stuff doesn't mean anything. It is totally watching somebody make human connections. And as you say, John, I mean, Jesus... He's just like a guy for me, but you're living a life
Jesus
like Jesus
is just
is
all right
incredible.
With you. Yeah, I mean, right.
Well, that is true.
If you could live, right, you could be presumably, and these people exist in droves, which are people who behave like Jesus and don't believe in him at all. And that's
I don't know about the in droves part of that. Sense,
oh, there are
the
totally
of
lots
of,
you know, secular and atheists who are wonderful to their, you know, fellow man, devote their entire life to service and helping others, and, you know, are totally selfless. And oh, I think those people do exist in big numbers.
No, of course they exist. And I don't think whether you're observant and religious has any bearing on whether you're one of those people. I just wish there were more of them.
Yeah. Well, amen to that.
Okay, let's move on to cocktail chatter. I don't know what the Pope definitely is a boozer. I'm sure he drinks. He definitely drinks. He's an Argentine. He's a soccer fan. He's a man who loves life. I'm sure he drinks. Well, so if you...
He's definitely drinking at basically every mass that
true.
He performs.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, John, if you were having an actual cocktail with the Pope, what might you chatter to him about?
Yeah, I don't think I'd chatter about this, but I'd be asking, you know, for a lot of intercessions. Hold on. I can't find the... I just called up the article, and now it disappeared. Hold on.
The Pope is holding for you, John. Don't worry.
Yeah, right. Why isn't it loading here? Oh, okay. So, as we all know from endless years of listening to the Gabfest, I'm fascinated with attention span and focus. And so there was this fascinating new, or it's not a new discovery. Well, it's a new discovery. It's a new synthesis of research that was done on the use of a video game called NeuroRacer to create increased focus and attention. Now, we've heard a lot, and there's been a lot written about computer games. Luminosity, I think, is the name of one service where basically it's like a bunch of brain teasers that are supposed to help you focus and help with your memory. But in studies, what they've found is basically all these games do is help you become better at playing stupid computer games. But what this study, and it was done, it's a ginormous study, what they seem to have discovered, the most significant contribution of the study, is that it does two things. One, it rebuts the view that an individual's capacity is fixed, that your cognitive capacity can't be grown. It suggests that your cognitive capacity can be grown. And then secondly, it finds that you can, by playing this game, which is basically a road racing game in which it gets increasingly harder as you master it, and basically the terrain shifts and you have to keep a lot of balls in the air as you're going. And for some reason, they found that your ability to focus in playing this game is then transferable to other things in your life. And that was the key problem with the Luminosity stuff, is that it was not transferable. You could get really good at the game, but then you couldn't remember the grocery list, or you couldn't write on deadline in a room full of screaming reporters. And so this obviously has huge implications for the elderly, but also people as they get older, which I didn't know. But apparently, as we get into our like late 20s, not only do we have problems with memory and focus, but the ramp up, the pain of switching from one task to the other, the mental and cognitive irritation that comes from writing a story and then switching over to go play the guitar, it gets harder as you get older to switch cognitive tasks. And so this, presumably, apparently, will make that easier. And then obviously it could help with kids with ADHD and that kind of thing. So this video game, which I think they're trying to make some more public version. This is only now in the laboratory environment. But we could all be like on the subway instead of playing Candy Crush. We could play NeuroRacer and be a much better society and have more time to.
I don't play Candy Crush on the subway. Do you play Candy Crush?
No, I don't play anything.
Me either.
No.
I listen to podcasts.
Yeah, no, I don't play any games.
NeuroRacer is the perfect name for this.
Yeah.
It makes it like 10 times more appealing. I also feel like this is hogwash in a way to just get us to spend more time on screens. But I know nothing about it.
Yeah, I mean, sure. I mean, I'm sure that somebody will say it's hogwash. But the study was, it seemed at least based on what I read in the piece in Nature, seemed to suggest that it had a lot of methodological heft behind it.
Well, how nice if a video game could improve our cognitive abilities.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
That's like the holy grail of video games.
I know.
Right?
You can imagine, like, it turns out that if you smoke a carton of Camels, play a video game, and drink a fifth of bourbon, you'll be able to, you know... You'll be the next pope.
Emily, what is your chatter?
I am reading a very enjoyable book from a kind of unlikely source. It's called Number 4 Imperial Lane. It is by Jonathan Wiseman, who is one of the mainstays of the Washington Bureau of the New York Times. And it's really literary and fun and written in such an entirely different voice from, you know, newspaper reporting that I'm just like wowed by Jonathan's ability to do this and just really like reading along with great enjoyment. It's a story of an American who decides to stay in Britain because he has fallen in love, but also it's about his entanglement with a family of sort of fallen aristocrats. They're called the Bromwells, and he is taking care of the brother who is a quadriplegic and getting all enmeshed in their twisted family history. I'm like halfway through, and I really recommend it. Number 4, Imperial Lane by Jonathan Wiseman.
Okay. I want to chat about something which has been talked up on probably about 4 different Slate podcasts, and I almost didn't do it because it's been talked up so much, but it is so good that I have to talk it up some more, which is there's a podcast called You Must Remember This by Karina Longworth. It's a History of Hollywood podcast, and she did a 12-part series this spring and summer about the Manson murders. And you just can't believe how great it is. It's like hardcore history meets Entertainment Tonight. Meets Whistle Stop.
Got that in there.
It's Whistle Stop meets Entertainment Tonight. It is a fantastic retelling of this incredibly crazy moment in American history. And I cannot recommend it highly enough. I gobbled it up. It's great. So You Must Remember This by Karina Longworth. Have you listened to it, John?
I haven't, but I've heard so much about it, and also that, you know, the Manson murders and the period in American culture, and I can imagine how beautifully and well rendered that could be, and it's amazing the shit that happened in American history. Anyway.
All right. Our intern is Tark Barrett, and if you want to be our intern, email us at gabfest@slate.com with your resume and cover letter for our paid part-time internship. Our producer this week is Jason De Leon. Andy Bowers is the executive producer of Slate Podcasts. The GabFest is part of the Panoply Network. Check out our entire roster of podcasts at itunes.com/panoply. Our show page is slate.com/gabfest, which has links to what we talked about today. Our Facebook page is facebook.com/gabfest. Our Twitter feed is @SlateGabFest. Our email address, again, where you're going to send your excellent internship application, is gabfest@slate.com. Please subscribe to the GabFest on iTunes and leave a comment and rating while you're there. For Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, I'm David Plotz. We will talk to you next week.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.